jeudi 24 février à 20h. Plus d'infos sur productionnuitdafrique.com.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is February 11th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyenkehaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
C is for
cauliflower,
confusion, creation,
pickle, K is for
kitten,
camp,
seat, wait, unroofsy, U, unbearable,
U is for underground,
oh, yeah,
umbrella,
T, trite,
tremendous,
torment,
tire,
C, K,
I can't think of a U one,
T,
F is for famous,
fun, fumble, M is for Montreal.
First, some news. A group of tenants in Toronto are fighting an abusive rent increase from their landlord, Starlight Investment. Several Montreal groups demonstrated on Thursday in front of the local offices of the Public Sector Pension Investment Board. They're a major investor in Starlight. Tenants also denounced the financialization of Montreal's housing market. And the head of a Montreal metal recycling company was arrested last week for dealing stolen vehicle catalytic converters. Converters are commonly stolen in Montreal, and the 28-year-old's home and St. Laurent office were raided by police and $260,000 were seized. The suspect is due to appear in court in the coming weeks. And the community group Solidarity Across Borders is holding a vigil for migrants who have died due to Canada's immigration policies. A person died in the CBSA Laval Migrant Prison on January 30th, and a family crossing the border in Manitoba froze to death just a week prior. At least 15 people have died in CBSA custody over the past 20 years. The vigil will be held outside the Border Service offices on St. Antoine West on February 13th at noon. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM.
COVID-19 is quickly circulating throughout the province of Quebec. It's essential that you get tested only if you have COVID-like symptoms. Symptoms such as fever, cough, and loss of taste or loss of smell. As you may already know, testing still remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. For more information, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The National Greening Program, run by Tree Canada, is dedicated to planting seedling trees across Canada in BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They prioritize planting on Indigenous and public lands and planting areas of natural and human-caused disturbance. The trees they plant help filter the air and water and sequester carbon, among other positive impacts. To learn more or get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. Up first on this episode, there's a surge of violence against civilians and community workers in Colombia. Blandine Rachel is an interpreter for the Montreal-based Community Solidarity Network, the Project Accompaniment Solidarité Colombie. The group was created in Quebec and has members locally and in Colombia. It aims to offer international solidarity to Colombians facing human rights abuses as a result of economic and political state interests within the continued neo-colonial relationship between the global north and south. Joel Salmadal has more.
So my name is Blandine, and I've been part of the PASS collective since 2005. I went there for the first time in 2005 and went there several times. And in the past 10 years, I've been living most of the time in Colombia, but still linked to the collective. And the rest of the members are mostly in what we call Quebec.
So I just wanted to find out more about what the collective is, what and the type of work that PASC does.
Sure. So actually, PASC was born and raised in Montreal in 2004 and 2005. So we were one of those international solidarity groups that were born out of the anti-globalization mobilization, the mobilization against the FTAA, and all those big demos at the beginning of the year 2000. And our general idea was to use direct solidarity as a way to deepen our struggle against capitalism. So we were pretty active in anti-capitalist scene in Montreal. And this is how we actually started to go down to Colombia, create relationships, and then be part of a network. So this was really the idea that we were sharing the same struggle, but also the idea that we knew that we were coming from the north of the continent and that our passport gave us a few privileges and how we could use that. So this is where the A from PASS comes from, which is accompaniment. It can sound like a weird name, but it's a pretty normal thing in Colombia that some organization consider themselves as accompaniers to other. That would be maybe a little bit what we've been calling allies then a few years after in Canada. So basically, PASS got involved in several campaigns depending on the work we were doing on the field. So we had a campaign on palm oil at the beginning of the year 2000. Then we started we were really present in the regions of Chocó. And then some of the people we were working with were jailed and became political prisoners. So we became active with political prisoners. And each time we were active on some struggle in Colombia, we kind of made the link with whatever we would be doing in Canada. So in Canada, we've been many others in solidarity with migrants and people that were detained, anti-prison networks and political prisoners networks. So we've been trying to build those bridges, for example, trying to have political prisoners from Colombia writing in the certain days calendars and other initiatives. And then through the years, it became clear that we had to focus more on the role of Canada and actually the responsibility of a Canadian state, specifically in promoting mining and oil companies that are really present in Latin America in general and in the case of Colombia. So we basically became that group that kind of have that specialty on the history of Colombia and its conflict and its social movements and the mobilization that happens there. But we've been always trying to make it clear that it's linked to our struggle in Canada and or Turtle Island. And another way to share those ideas, it's been to do popular education in the north of the continent. So for example, whatever we learned about feminist struggles, environmental struggles or others, we've been trying to give it back to the north too. So we've been using theater of the oppressed, we've been using videos, we've been using writings, photos, and many other tools to share the ideas, yeah, all the things that happen when you get involved in a struggle. So that's a bit, in a few words, of what PASC does. That's a long story because it's almost 20 years. It's been 18 years. So we had many campaigns and worked on many issues.
It seems that you guys have a pretty solid presence both on the ground in Colombia and also here in Canada. I just wanted to go into like how you guys maintain that network.
Yeah, so first of all, because we're part of bigger networks and coalition, because actually PASC is a collective, so we've been, you know, between 10 and 15 members, and we have a huge network of people that just help. A lot of people help us with interpretation, translation, and video editing, you know, or many others, small tasks. But it's because we're part of networks. So, for example, in the north, we're part of the PERG, the UCAM PERG, GRIP UCAM, and we're part of the network of environmental groups, and we've been part of several coalition with other groups working on Latin America or on other issues. And for us, it's been really important. And it's a bit of the same in Colombia. In Colombia, we're part of a network called REDER, and there's also other collectives that looks like us in Argentina, in Europe, and all together, we've been working to have common campaigns and common goals. So it's, you know, it's because we have all those network that it actually happens. But then in terms of a substance of how, I think, for example, for us, it's been really important to share some of the way people are in struggle in Colombia. For example, it's not rare in Colombia to see an indigenous community fighting against a mega open pit mining project and have the support of settlers and have the support of unionized worker with that idea of territory. So it's in the past years, and thanks to really strong indigenous struggles, it's been more okay to talk about territory in the north of the continent, but it wasn't the case many years ago. And that whole idea of territory, not just land, but territory, like the whole relationship you have, the whole social network you have, and the fact that even if you're a worker or if you're in an indigenous struggle, or if you're a settler, then we can have some common grounds on how to struggle together. So it's been pretty interesting to bring those ideas back. And on the other hand, it's been pretty amazing to have the privilege to help build the bridges. For example, lately people in Colombia have been asking a lot about colonizers' statues being taken down, because it's been happening a lot in Colombia and a lot in Canada. So, you know, like trying to help out, even if sometimes it's just a contact interpretation, so that community can talk together, or for example, just making a translation of an article from a political prisoners from Colombia in order to put it in the calendar of political prisoners from North America, you know, like some small things that actually make sense.
Yeah, and that's the part about PASC that I think I found very interesting, how you guys are so well grounded on both continents with such a wide network of contacts and activity on both continents. So on January 19th, there was an attack in Saravena in Colombia, which left one dead and many injured. And I just wanted to ask if you could tell us more about this attack and the general background on it, like who was behind it and who was targeted and what were the reasons behind it?
Yeah, so first of all, it's a complicated story. So I'll try to make it clear, and please stop me if I'm not, because and it's been pretty complex, because usually, and maybe some background here, usually the war that is raging in Colombia is pretty straightforward. You have the state with their military and paramilitary actors, so paramilitary being the illegal arm of the government, that attack any kind of opposition and any kind of political project that goes away from their politics. So that includes socialists, communists, that includes any kind of anti-capitalists, but that also includes some social democrats and other people who just want some democratic reform. So, you know, like opposition in a really wide sense. But in that specific case, it's a bit more complicated to explain because maybe people are familiar with the concept of hybrid wars and with the with the concept of false flag and so forth. So it's been kind of complicated because in that specific case, this is a front of what's called the FARC. So it is a front 28. So for anyone who knows Colombia, it sounds weird that FARC, which used to be Marxist, Leninist, communist guerrilla that could have done good and bad things in their lives, but that are supposed to be to have signed a peace agreement in 2016 would be behind these kind of attacks. So in order to explain that, I'll just quote what our partners have been telling us on the ground. And what they say is that it's actually not a real FARC front, because some of the FARC members didn't sign the agreement and stayed as a guerrilla and not became a political party. Others became a political party, and a third part was betrayed and decided to go back to war. So you have several types of FARC nowadays. But in that specific case, on the Front 28, we would have a fourth type of situation in which even the new FARC, even the new armed FARC, say that whoever is claiming to be FARC in that case are people that were deserters more than 15 years ago. And it seems they could have been working with the government of Colombia. So it's a pretty complicated situation because you have a group that claims to be revolutionary, that declares a war to another guerrilla, and that becomes more complicated. I know I've been talking about more than five armed groups, and this is what's been happening in the war lately in Colombia. You have the ELN. So what's been said by the government and by mass media is that since January 3rd, we have a war raging between the ELN and the FARC for drug trafficking. But what we see is that it's actually a war from the 28th Front of the FARC, or a group calling himself Front 28 from the FARC, who's been doing public threats on YouTube, few videos, and they've been attacking social movements. Also, something that we have to know about Arauca region and the specific town of Saravena, where the car bomb exploded on the 19th, is that it's a pretty strong region in terms of social struggles. They have many strikes. They've been fighting against big oil industry and pipelines and so forth. And what they have is a really strong social fabric of cooperatives. So their oil production in the region is organized through self-managed cooperatives. They have their own water supply system, and they have a pretty strong connection among the community. And this is a threat. This always has been a threat to the government. People are being criminalized. They've been facing false accusation. They've been jailed. They've been assassinated and so forth. So now you have that group who's calling himself the 28th Front of the FARC, who actually take all the arguments from, for example, the prosecutor's office in order to accuse those organizations to be close to the ELN. So what happened on the 19th is that there was already many threats, because on January 9th, a grenade was thrown at the office of the water supply company, which is a community company. And then many people were actually targeted and assassinated in the days before. And on the 19th, people who were already scared that something like that would happen. So yeah, so basically the car bomb on the 19th was the major event because it was, sorry, I'll just speak some water. Yeah, so basically it was huge, but it was actually not the most deadly of all the attacks of the past weeks. So it's been a really strong increase in the war in the region. So I don't know if I made it clear because it's a pretty complicated issue, but basically the conclusion on that is that it's kind of all good for the government because the actual government, they're going toward election. And war is kind of their business. So they like to put in the public opinion that there's war and there need to be more militaries and there need to be more militarization. On the other side, they want the social organization to be scared and have to fly out of their region and have to and disappear, basically. So this is a second element which is in favor of the government. And third, because they have no intention to comply the agreement with the FARC or to negotiate peace with the ELN, and they want to eliminate any kind of opposition, making all that look like there's crazy groups fighting each other over drug trafficking is actually a pretty good excuse for militarization. Maybe if like two more elements in terms of analysis would be that Saravena is actually on the border of Venezuela. So militarizing the border of Venezuela is pretty important for Colombian government because they have agreements with the U.S. government and they have interests of Colombia being the base for military pressure against Venezuela. And maybe another element is that even if the narrative from the mass media has been that it's a struggle among two illegal groups for drug trafficking route. If you see even the reports from Homeland Security in the US, you can see that this border in Arauca is not a place that is the strategic place. Like most of the drug trafficking goes through actually the Pacific coast or the Caribbean coast. Like if you check a map for a second, it's pretty obvious, but it makes no sense that this would be the main road for any kind of trafficking. It's a bit far from everything, let's say. And another key issue is that actually Arauca has been free of coca leaf crops for the past 5 years, and not thanks to the government, but thanks to this social fabric and those cooperatives that actually have been organizing in order to get rid of those crops because of the social and economical consequences they had. And the cooperatives are the ones that finance the whole transition in order to eradicate coca leaf crops. So yeah, that would be trying to say in short, a very complicated story.
No, thank you. That was very helpful. Get into like just the depth and breadth of the situation facing the region at the time and like all the different factors that played into that attack. You mentioned that the building that was attacked was a building that had a lot of community organizations. I just wanted to ask, what was the significance behind that?
So it's an historical building in which you can find the Office of Alternative Media, Trechando Sin Frontera. You can find the offices of the Human Rights Association, of the unions, of the Youth Association, and many others. So this is really a symbolic place in which actually when people were scared and under attack and under threat, they actually went there in order to feel safer, right? So attacking this building was really a strong statement in terms of threat, but in terms of saying like, we can reach you wherever you are. So it was pretty important.
And since then, how has the work of PASC been affected?
So in that specific case, PASC usually try to have people on the ground. So one of the campaigners that was there at the time went there immediately on the 19th, and spent 2 weeks there doing interviews, trying to understand better the situation. And this is why PASC has been publishing so many videos and elements on the situation. We have to say that it's a region that we know well, like many of us also. You know, we stayed at that building for many weeks or sometimes many months, and we have strong relationship with the people there. So we also failed the attack, several of us. And what we've been doing is trying to raise awareness and trying to give another perspective to kind of change that mainstream idea of that. If you see in mainstream media, even in Canada, some of them did report about those events, but they said, oh, there's illegal groups fighting each other over drug trafficking, avoiding totally to put any kind of responsibility on the Colombian state. And in that case, we understand it's hard to understand. And so we've been trying to provide information, to provide evidence that there's another story to be told about what's happening there. Oh, and also we've been helping out because we're raising funds to rebuild the building. So this is something I should not forget to mention.
That ties into my next question, which was just going to be, where can we find the work that you do and the messages that you do put out?
So you can find us on EVIL platforms like Twitter and Facebook. Usually in French, Projet Accompagnement Solidarité Colombie, or even PASC. We try to publish as much as possible in English, but actually, and here's the call, we need more people to help us with translation toward English, because as you can hear, most of us are Francophones, and it's been harder to follow through because we're translating a lot of things from Spanish, and you can find us at pasc.ca, so PASC.ca, and you can find the website in English, in French, and in English. And it's it's basically the three places, but also whenever there's public events, we try to have some newspaper and some materials in the past years because of all the digital era in which we are. We've been publishing less, but actually we're gonna publish a review specifically on Arauca that we were actually already working on in the past weeks, in a month or so. So we'll have a public event with actual human beings seeing each other. This is gonna be amazing.
That is such a not common thing anymore. That sounds like it's gonna be a really good time. Is that here? Where is that gonna be, the in-person meeting?
Huh, I should know that. I'm not sure we know yet, but it's gonna be in Montreal. But I don't know exactly where, because as everybody's aware, it's not so easy to find a place and the conditions and everything in the times around. But we really hope we're going to be able to have a nice public event in Montreal, and we'll let you know, and you can find out on Facebook and on the website. Also on the website, you can register to our mailing list. I know this is old school, but we still have a mailing list on which you can receive actual emails with news about PASC. We usually publish a newsletter every 3 months.
Would there be any final messages or thoughts that you wanted to?
No, just if someone's listening to the story and feel like they want to know more about PASC and our perspectives, or feel like they want to go in Colombia or get involved in any way, actually, please feel free to reach us. The email is info@pasc.ca, and we are always happy to have new friends and new campaigns and new things to do.
Thank you. It was nice talking to you and to learn more about PASC.
Thank you for having us.
Welcome back to CKUT. You were just listening to Blandine Rachel and the Project Accompaniment Solidarité Colombie. Now for the second segment of the hour, we're going to be sharing the air with producer Pam Palmater and her Warrior Life podcast. She talks with lawyer, advocate, and Senator Kim Pat about recent trucker convoy and occupation of Ottawa. will bring you back at the top of the hour with some news that you can use.
Hey, how's it going? We are just trying to get set up now. I'm going to be going live with Senator Kim Pate. What we wanted to do was talk about what's happening in Algonquin territory right now, unceded, unsurrendered, sovereign Algonquin territory, which, as we know, Ottawa is in that area and the truckers, but we know it's so much more than that. All of the protesters that are there, all of the hate groups that are there, and what's happening to the people on the ground in Ottawa, which basically has nothing to do with vaccinations at this point. And so Senator Kim Pate and I, who is literally right there, she and I wanted to talk about all of these issues because there's a lot of issues that aren't getting picked up in the mainstream media. We know that sometimes mainstream media struggles to cover the issues of everyday people and tends to focus on the bigger, flashier things, but there's a lot of people who are not being served, not being protected, who are being negatively impacted. This goes really beyond a protest. There's a million issues that Senator Kim Pate and I want to talk about. But one of the things that's really upsetting from an Indigenous point of view is how they have been over these last few days mocking and ridiculing and degrading and disrespecting Indigenous peoples, Indigenous lands, Indigenous cultures, Indigenous practices. So first and foremost, they went and planned this massive disorganized hate rally on sovereign unceded Algonquin territory without any collaboration or coordination with grassroots Indigenous peoples, traditional leaders, elected leaders. And so, of course, they brought all of their hatred to Indigenous territory. That is bad enough. But when you also talk about the fact that they had groups of what looked like white people there drumming randomly, shouting yabba-dabba-doo and making fun of our cultural practices around drumming and singing for particular purposes. They had no purpose. They didn't respect any of the protocols. And that was obviously and very much inherently racist. And so they got called out on that inherent racism. How did they respond? They tried to find someone that would claim to be Indigenous that would make it look like they were supporting them, not just politically, but in a cultural way. So you have this fake group, they're a fake Métis group, and we know this isn't just political rhetoric. They've gone to the courts have said, listen, this, you're just doing frivolous actions, you have no basis of indigeneity, you have no claims, and they're out there, again, looking just like these hate groups. They don't know the songs, they don't know how to drum, they don't know the protocols, they're not at all coordinated with the actual sovereign Indigenous governing body on that territory. And so they are ridiculing us at the same time. And by lending their support to hate groups, which are inherently racist and anti-Indigenous, I think it's a pretty key sign that they aren't in fact Indigenous at all. And so this is something that's really upsetting a lot of people, and I noticed just a few moments ago on Twitter that some of the local Indigenous peoples have issued statements about this, saying that this has got to stop, all this fakery, all this fraudulent representation, all of this disrespect of Indigenous culture in Indigenous territory. So we know some people might say, oh, this is just a handful of people. But social media pictures, all of the photographs, the video, the audio recordings shows that this is happening on a widespread basis, that racialized people, Indigenous, Black, Asian, and other people are literally being targeted by people in the trucker convoy. And so we know that this whole movement is inherently racist. But one of the things that Senator Kim Pate and I wanted to talk about was that there's other groups that are being deeply impacted. So beyond residents not being able to get any sleep, not even be able to find any parking, not being able to go out and get food or groceries, not being safe to go to and from work or to and from school, the malls have closed, we have daycares that have had to close, we've had lots of problems just in and around the neighborhoods. But think about other people who live with daily disabilities. So there were people who had mobility issues, there were people who had sight disabilities, limited sight or no sight, who were posting and saying that they have to go a certain way to their grocery store every day to get what it is that they need. Those ways are blocked off, or they've made attempts to get there, but the area was closed because of these violent protests, or even worse, they didn't feel safe, or they were being threatened on their way to and from this area. It doesn't figure very well that people who claim to be about human rights, and we know that this is just a front, but they're claiming to be about human rights, are categorically disregarding all of the human rights of all of the people in that area. So there's indigenous peoples, there's everyday people in the neighborhood, there's the disabled peoples, and then there's people who are literally trying to protect their health. So people who are health compromised and people who actually don't want to get COVID or any other serious infection, wearing their masks, which it's the scientific recommendation for us to keep our distance, wear masks, get your vaccinated shots, don't gather in crowds. So knowing that there's massive crowds out there, people are wearing their masks, trying not to get COVID from all these hate groups and anti-vaxxers. And they're actually being targeted because they're wearing masks. They're being assaulted, they're being threatened, they're being shoved around, they're not being allowed to move freely throughout their own neighborhoods. And we've seen some social media posts where people have actually called the police to say, I'm being threatened, I'm being harassed, I'm not able to go to my home or work or the gym safe because I'm wearing my mask. And the best advice the police have to offer is don't wear your mask. Literally, don't protect yourself from the massive crowds of anti-vaxxers who can give you COVID because they are acting in a criminal and threatening way. So the police aren't even helping individuals out there. They're not helping regular citizens. And I mean, it's pretty rich, because if you think about it, for all of this time, for how many years now have we been marching in the streets about defund, dismantle the police? The police are not there when you need them, but they're the first ones there to commit acts of violence and racism and oppression against indigenous peoples and black peoples, killing us at grossly disproportionate rates to other people. And the police comeback is always, oh, where would you be if you defunded us? That's a really good question to all of the police forces, including those in Ottawa. Where are citizens right now when they call the police? They're nowhere. The truckers aren't being removed. The hate groups aren't being removed. In fact, one of the most alarming things I saw were the police allowing these protest participants to carry carts full of gasoline close to Parliament. In what world would Indigenous peoples or Black peoples and a big angry mob be allowed to carry flammables anywhere near Parliament or Senate or any of the government offices? There's very good reasons why people have been saying defund the police. Because one, they don't put energy into preventing crime. They don't do a very good job of investigating crime. The two of us together trying to do this on our own without kids around is. But just before you got here, I told them that we wanted to talk about the issues that aren't necessarily being covered in the media, beyond the politics and the people, the actual citizens who are being impacted. So I started out talking about Indigenous peoples, how they're disrespecting our culture, doing fake drumming and ridiculing us, and how they are not respecting local Indigenous peoples. I was talking about some of the people with disabilities who can't make it to and from or feeling safe. And then I was talking about the police and how the police tried to defend themselves against defund the police requests by citizens by saying, what would you do without us? Who could you call to protect you? And in this instance, citizens do call the police and they're not being protected. But I know that you were looking at some of the other issues that were coming up online and in the media. Yeah, go ahead, because I've just been jabber jaws this whole time.
No, Thank goodness for you. Oh, I'm so sorry I'm late. I was texting everyone, my daughter, everybody, like, how do I do this? And I was seeing your texts, and I don't know how you were talking and texting me at the same time. You're amazing. But yeah, no, I'm really worried. I've been worried for some time that we're seeing the same sort of push to really conservative, individualistic ideas at a time when we need collective action. When more have we known this than during this pandemic? It's shown how unequal so many people are. It's shown the divisions in terms of the people who have money and those who don't, between Indigenous peoples and non-Indigenous peoples, and between racialized people. The hardest hit in terms of the pandemic, economically and health-wise, have been those who are poor and those who are racialized. And so when I started seeing people coming in, it wasn't the big trucking companies, not a big surprise, because they've got money. I suspect some people started. I mean, one of the problems with movements like this that we're seeing right now in this convoy is they start with really simple, basic messages that appeal to a lot of people. Freedom, how doesn't that appeal to people? But then in there are white supremacist attitudes, are racist attitudes, are actually anti-collective attitudes. So the fact that they're describing it freedom to not be vaccinated, when the Truckers Association says everybody should be vaccinated, when you've had to be vaccinated to go to the US for, I don't know how many months, if not a year or more. And the fact that they're picking on at a time when people are feeling insecure, particularly economically and health-wise, picking on this means it's ripe for a real, just like we've seen historically, for really right-wing, awful attitudes and biases. And then we see the police saying, yeah, we need to de-escalate, that it's peaceful protests. Tell that to all the women, the people with disabilities, the poor people who, you know, who had things being taken, big food literally taken out of their mouths by people going to the shelter, to the food soup kitchen, the Shepherds of Good Hope. And I sent you some pieces about people with disabilities not being able to get groceries, women being afraid to walk outside because if they put a mask on, some guy's following them saying, I'm going to follow you to your house and I'm not just going to take your mask off. And so, of course, they don't even want to go home. We've had people standing in the streets. And then the police are saying, well, we don't want to escalate. And to me, it's so emblematic of the issues you and I talk about all the time, that whether it's the underlying the missing and murdered Indigenous women, the fact that violence against women and violence and hatred and the things that are often, we know there's a real threat of violence, but because you don't see someone physically shot or bashed over the head, the perception is that it's not violent, and that's not true at all. This kind of bullying, oppressive tactics are actually what lead to people being silent about and fearful of expressing what they need. And so I'm extremely concerned that this is a moment where we need to come together and say, yes, the people who are economically disadvantaged because of all kinds of things that predate this pandemic, and that are about inequalities that existed in this country that predate this, the health issues, are something that the government needs to take bold action about, is really important. And it's why you and I and the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry and 50 years ago, the Senate talked about things like guaranteed livable income, talked about real health care, talk about land back, talk about defund the police. It's because we don't want to see a macho, militaristic approach to anything, whether it's protests or whether it's saying, how do we live collectively? How do we live and work together? And then add to that, I hope it's just a few. I grew up a service brat. I grew up in the military. I've worked in and around prisons. And that macho, militaristic attitude that too often pervades, whether it's policing, corrections, certainly we know in the military, is part of the challenge. How do you have a more equitable situation when you systems that presume some people have power over other people, and we don't work collectively when we are in a situation where you have power over other people? And so I think it's really important now that we try and, you know, encourage people to think about, what do we do to move together out of this? Not to foment more hatred, not to pretend that certain people, poor people, Indigenous people, other racialized people are to blame for the economic insecurity, and certainly going towards a more a militaristic approach to how we run the country is certainly not it. And just before I came on, I see that the Conservatives have decided to oust their leader. And I don't know what that means in this moment. Now, is he being blamed for not being right-wing enough? That's one of the allegations. Yeah. And we know what happens in the past when you have that kind of white supremacist nationalist ideology and blaming of people who don't have the same privileges, whether it's Jewish people, Indigenous people, whether mm-hmm. it's poor people. And that's unfortunately what I see happening right now. And then people being afraid to not knowing what to do because they're being bullied into submission. And when you hear people with disabilities, people whose families are dying, ambulance drivers saying their ambulances were being pelted with rocks. I don't know where that, I have some idea of where the anger comes from, but that, like, when could it ever be justified and why? And I think if those individual people were stopped and said, would you do this to your mother? Would you do this to someone in your family? Most of them would say no. So why would you do it to somebody else just because you don't know them? And so I think we really have, I'm hoping people will wake up to this and say, this is not Canada. This is not the country we want to live in. This, we need to take serious, if we're saying we're taking seriously our relationship with First Nations people, Inuit, Métis, and First Nations, then we need to engage in a different type of discussion. And when we have in the same city, as so many have pointed out, Black Lives Matter and Indigenous land back protesters being arrested and treated as in very negative ways, very differently from the way these folks have been treated, who are coming in with massive trucks. And the only charges that have been laid so far, and believe me, I'm not interested in criminalizing a whole bunch of people, is that the only charges laid here compared to peaceful protests of the past has been one incident of mischief. I don't know what that is. Another one is a gun charge. I don't want armed people out pretending that this is a peaceful protest. It's no wonder people are afraid. And we have to put, these are policy decisions. And I think a bold step by our government to say, we're dealing with the health issues and we are going to be dealing with the economic issues and we are working on that and really taking some measures to ensure those who have the least are supported is vitally important right now. And next week, Leah Gazan and I introduced a bill together. Hers is Bill 223. Mine is S-233. The S means it's in the Senate. The C means it's in the House of Commons to develop a framework for an economic part of the economic recovery we need to see. We also, many of my colleagues who are business guys, if we did some of the tax reform that is being discussed, we could pay for all of these initiatives. So saying that we can't afford housing, we can't afford clean water, we can't afford food security or economic security is actually wrong. Those are policy decisions that are being made. And for the people who've joined this because that's what their concerns are about, I say, get out from behind pseudo-wing stuff and start focusing on how do we actually address these issues. And there's a bunch of us who want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think most of us are under any disillusion that this is really about anti-vaccines, because if you look at the people who fundraised for it, who organized, who have been taking responsibility, claiming that they're the organizers, they're all far right, white supremacists. Some of them are with hate groups, KKK groups, neo-Nazi groups, just out there inflaming and instigating. So we know that this isn't about vaccines. We know this isn't about human rights, because if it was, they would take extreme precautions not to violate the human rights of others during their advocacy. It's really hard sometimes to peel through all the noise and all the political rhetoric. It's like this commentator saying this, and this is what's being said on social media, that now's the time to really focus on the facts. And what do we see and what are we experiencing? And our collectivity, our neighborhoods, Indigenous peoples and others in and around that Ottawa area are saying, here's what we're experiencing. Threats of violence, actual violence, assaults, theft, vandalism, noise, defecations, bottles of urine. Like, that is nothing anywhere remotely near having a conversation around vaccines. And all that does is hurt people. And one of the questions the media asked me was, what do you see the difference between Indigenous or Black Lives Matter protests or demonstrations or land defense and this one? And while there's a million of them, I will say from an Indigenous point of view, when we organize something, we make sure, A, it's organized. We follow our Indigenous laws. There's cultural protocols. There's protocols for friends, allies, and supporters to join us, but they have to follow certain protocols. And the number one protocol we've had, whether it's Idle No More or any of the demonstrations we've ever done, is safety for the people involved, safety for the people who join us. And things like, we would never invite people to join us in an event that would last a long time without food, water, medical assistance, paramedics, human rights observers, lawyers, making sure that everyone's taken care of. On this side of things, they're literally doing the opposite. It's like literally inviting thousands of people to Indigenous territories without a care for how they're going to get by, how they're going to survive. And that creates anger and anxiety and makes things even worse. And I think that the worst part about all of this is that it works for hate groups. This is exactly what hate groups love. They love chaos and anger, and we don't know who to believe, and conspiracy theories, like every single media outlet is bought or owned by someone, or certain groups are controlling society, or lizard men, or like all the conspiracies out there. And that distracts. When we're really trying to have a conversation, is how do we protect ourselves collectively in a pandemic in a way that respects everyone's human rights and minimizes any interference? And I guess when I come down to it, we know here in Canada, our human rights are so protected that no one is ever going to strap someone down to a table and force them to have a vaccination. No more than they would go up to your car and force you to put on your seatbelt and put a lock on it. But there's certain protections and safety that we have to do as a society to prevent deaths. And seatbelts, other vaccinations, other certifications. So it's not like this is anything new. Unfortunately, it's being used to rally all of these hate groups. And I'm very concerned about what this means. Because, Kim, I don't know if you saw it, but there was a video of actual truckers stuck at the Canada-US border since January 29th, actual truckers, no food, no water, no medicine, no ability to get in or out because of all of these angry groups. How does that help those truckers who are underpaid and need better benefits and whom we all want to advocate for? And that concerns me, because they're just distracting from the real socioeconomic needs of all of us together.
Exactly. No, and I agree. I think the fact that there were calls to come and converge, much like what happened south of the border last year, and people coming because they're frustrated and then joining, and even the demands being made don't necessarily make any sense, because we've long had vaccination schemes, not to oppress people, but to protect the population. And as we're seeing with this, if every one of us is not in a position to be healthy, then we will have, as we are having, successive waves. And so the idea that people are being oppressed versus working on collective action for the collective good is really important. And so I think we need to, I think the responsibility of the government is to say, yeah, we've taken health guidelines seriously. We've taken some, we've done some really good things about economic development, but we've still left a whole bunch of people behind, and we haven't combined protection of the climate, protection of land, protection of people who are now being blamed for the situation that the country is in, instead of saying, look, we need to work collectively. This is, we've taken one step. It's one step in the right direction. We need to keep moving. And so I'm hopeful that people will see that. I'm hopeful that the folks who have camped out downtown will go home, but then join in support of the very groups that are working for economic, social, racial, gender equality, and not continue to think that bullying other people or being downtown and causing PTSD for people who can't sleep, children, just people with disabilities, people, women who are scared to go out, people who can't get out, people who can't get to see their loved ones or to even get groceries, is that's that kind of oppression doesn't garner support. And in fact, I fear just the opposite, that it's making people look like a bunch of just wing racist fascist rabble rousers. If you or I were at a protest and someone pulled out a Nazi, any kind of Nazi symbol,
wow,
or racist symbol, we know what would happen. We would escort that person away. We wouldn't just say that's just a one bad apple. We'd be saying we
exactly
have to stop this, and we cannot. And so the fact that it's feeding these ideas that somehow the media is against them, all of that. No, the public is becoming against them, and they're actually undoing the very important messages that some of them, I'm sure some of them came with really important messages to share, but it's being lost. And all that's happening is people are getting frustrated. And it's revealing that, in fact, it's not people who are interested in making progress in this country. It's people who are interested only selfishly in perhaps their own interests or in the interests of a very small few. And it's promoting white supremacy. It's promoting the very negative, stereotypic ideas that we often associate with the far. And if that's what they wanted, maybe some people will want that. But I think in this country, most people do not. And
no,
certainly I don't. And I know you don't. And we need to be pushing and using this energy, the energy of people, to make sure everybody's taken care of. Make sure everybody has a place to live, clean water, food, clothing, housing, and education. That's the reality, is too many people have gone without for too long in this country. And much of the rise of these kinds of groups have come post-World War II, when the state pulled away and stopped providing support.
Yeah.
And after the development of Marshall Plans and that sort of thing, people started to lose faith in the government. And so I think the government has to act as well, obviously. But
yeah,
to pretend that making everything more oppressive is one way to do it is just wrong. And
yeah,
equating vaccines, encouraging people to have vaccinations, encouraging people to be able to make a living, going against your own associations doesn't achieve that. It actually does the opposite.
What? My radio stuck on CKUT. I don't know. But nah, fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to Pam Palmater's Warrior Life podcast. This show was from February 4th. You can find more of her content at pampalmater.com. And before you go, some news that you can use. Concordia University's FreeGoVert now has free drug testing kits and services at their downtown location on campus. They'll be open every Friday from 12 to 4 p.m. starting this week. Concordia is also now back in person for classes as of February 3rd. And FRAPRU is holding a protest in opposition to the privatization of housing assistance on Saturday, February the 12th. The protest comes in response to rising rent prices, which has made affordable housing in Montreal increasingly inaccessible for many tenants. This Saturday, February 12th at 1:30 outside Guy Concordia Metro. And the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal and Quebec Native Women are hosting an honor walk in remembrance of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, Two-Spirit, and queer people. The event is in partnership with the ISKU Project. They aim to raise awareness and find solutions to the double discrimination and violence against Indigenous women and femmes. That walk starts at 6 p.m. on Monday in Cabot Square.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize?
Consciousness is affected.
There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on.
And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, Tess Pilkington, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or newsintern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at Off the Hour, or connect with us on Facebook, search for us on CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next on 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir tout le monde, vous êtes sur les ondes de CKUT à votre émission d'art et de culture préférée du vendredi, Café. C'est Alex qui vous parle en ce vendredi 11 février. Ce soir, l'émission sera consacrée entièrement à l'entrevue réalisée il y a quelques semaines avec l'auteur et illustrateur Étienne Prudhomme. Dans cette heure, nous apprendrons à connaître le travail de cet artiste en parlant de sa plus récente création, la bande dessinée Bang, 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 le crépuscule des amochés, paru chez Mécanique Générale en octobre dernier. Aussi, à l'instar de la bande dessinée, l'entrevue sera ponctuée de musique pour nos fidèles auditeuristes mélomanes. On va d'ailleurs commencer cette entrevue par une pièce tirée de la playlist proposée par Étienne pour mettre la table avec A Divine Image de David Axelrod, donc pièce musicale tirée des films de genre noir, tout comme la bande dessinée, vous allez voir.